Okay, hi everyone. Many of you know me, but I don't think we've met Laraz either, have we? Anyway, I'm Lisa Smith. What?
You met me some time ago, but it's been a while. Nice to see you again, Lisa.
Yep. So, anyway, I'm Lisa Smith, the Chief Program Officer here at the network, and I get the honor and pleasure of hosting these affinity groups or just facilitate, coordinating them. Jeff Lev is our fearless chair of this group. So he's really the one who's going to be facilitating. But I'm so glad you all are on this call. If everyone can just write their, community where they are after their name, that would be great. And if you have a camera, we want to see you because with NJHSA, you want to be seen and heard. So with that
And
being
I have to do the public service announcement. At one point, NJHSA was supplying cameras. I don't know if you have any left in the stock room.
We have very few left, and we've
Okay.
decided that all new executives and COOs, that's their gift that they get when they come into the network. Yeah, we gave out $10,000 worth of cameras.
Wow. I'm
So,
guessing almost all of us have laptops now because of remote work, and almost all laptops have cameras. So maybe the external webcam is a thing of the past. It's the dodo bird, if you will.
interesting. Is everyone here working from a laptop?
Nope.
No. Me either. Okay. Well, with that being said, Ron, where are you calling in from? Where are you?
I am calling in from home today.
No, what town?
Oh, CJE Senior Life in Chicago.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay, so you want to take it away?
Sure. So I unfortunately, usually I can live up to the title fearless, but now it's fearful and anxious and lots of emotions, as I'm sure everybody else is feeling. To quote Lisa in her invite, "Oh my, so much has happened in the time since we've met, indeed." And I think when Lisa and I traded emails, and I'm sorry, Jeff Lev, COO of Jewish Family Service in Metro Detroit, a couple of the topics that I thought might be very timely are COVID and the return to work policy around COVID.
Oh,
If
that's
people are still dealing with PPP or furloughs or whatever other issues they're working with, we can talk about that too. And then the other thing that we wanted to talk about, and maybe Lee has a particularly focused perspective on this because of where he is. But Lisa and I talked just after the murder of George Floyd and the need to maybe talk about diversity, equity, inclusion issues broadly, and more specifically, talk about anti-racism and what our agencies are doing to address that. And because this is an HR group, primarily from the employee standpoint, but happy to discuss people we serve, funders, donors, stakeholders, whatever you want to talk about. So that's our tentative agenda for today. And I'm sure we could take well more than 51 minutes to talk about that. But if there's anything else people have on their minds, happy to hear that now too. And you can write in the chat or you can speak, whatever you prefer.
Well, first, I just want to introduce Vita because I see Vita's on there. She's my intern for the summer here at Goodman JFS.
Hi, Vita.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're
I
all
didn't know
very
that HR professionals had interns. I thought that was really just for social workers
Nope.
and other, clinical
You
services.
know what? Just look at my office. You can see how piling it things are piling up.
I can't
Very,
remember
very
where Goodman
often.
is.
The CEO of our agency, Perry Oren, he has an intern almost every year
You're
for
kidding.
leadership. It's called the Jewish Communal Leadership Program at U of M School of Social Work. And there's a particular track called administration or management or something like that. So he has one every year.
Wow. So what do people think about what Jeff just said in terms of any of the issues that he brought up?
Well, here in Florida, things are pretty bad. And we were going to actually reopen July 6th, that week after 4th of July. But due to the increase of the COVID-19 down, especially here in Broward and Dade County, and then there was a couple of cases actually on campus here too at the Federation, we have delayed it. And it looks like it's going to be delayed for a while down here too now, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. So what does that mean?
Well, that means because we're trying to get everybody back, because the key question is, you know, productivity from the employees, because we have like 80 employees. And we're always concerned about productivity, you know, when they're working from home and, you know, case managers and, you know, regular admins, you know, can they fulfill their 7 to 8 hours a day at home and all that. So we're trying to get back. Some of the Federation down here in Broward, they are back at work, but they're thinking of sending their people back home too, their employees home too, unfortunately. It's rough down here in South Florida.
So Laraz, you're muted. You agree?
Yes, I am understanding what Philip is talking about. We actually here at JFNCS here in Atlanta, Director of Human Resources, and hello everyone. I am actually going through, or the agency was going through phase one where we were slowly allowing people into the office only with authorization to access the office. So people weren't fully working within the office. Most were still teleworking and telecommuting. Unfortunately, within the last 3 weeks, we've had employees who had family members testing positive for COVID. And with the spikes, you know, the recent spikes in COVID exposures and positive testing, we think that we're now going to go back to phase zero, if that's a true number, where we're no longer in the office, only administration and finance will be accessing the office. It's so close to home now, it's almost in our office now.
Yeah.
We're still in phase zero, so we never left it. And despite the fact that Michigan at one point was in really bad shape, think New York, New Jersey, we had some pretty austere measures in the beginning. And now it appears to me things are better than they are in many states, but we've maintained our position that, and we have the governor's words to quote, promote remote work to the fullest extent possible. So throughout, we've had a couple of people in our finance department go in once a week to cash checks and cut checks. We've got somebody at the front desk to receive mail, and then a handful of people are in once in a while. But we've got about 115 employees, and on any given day, we probably only have 6 or 8 in the office. And I think the biggest issue for us is our geriatric care management. It's hard to do that remotely. Number one, because the people we serve tend not to be the most technologically proficient. And number two, it's hard to see trip hazards and inside refrigerators over a computer screen. Yeah. So right now, our main focus is figuring out how to get our clinicians in the homes of the people who need home visits and a handful of counseling clients who, for whatever reason, can't use Zoom or is not as effective in Zoom. But, you know, for us, we're sort of buckled up for the long haul. Like, I don't personally expect to be in the office for many months.
But so it's interesting what you said. Because Philip is saying, well, how do you account for people who are working from home? You know, as HR professionals, how do you know they're really doing what they're doing? I guess is what
you're saying. Exactly.
You know, and if you're in it for the long haul, you know, what are people doing about that? Or have people come up with solutions or anything?
Sure. So I think a lot of it comes down to trust, I think. So just as somebody could sit in his, her, their office or his, her, their cube and play Minesweeper or watch Netflix or whatever you could do rather than work, the same thing is true at home. So I think my philosophy and our philosophy, I guess, as an agency is that we put a lot of that responsibility on the supervisor. So regardless of whether you're working from home or from the office or from a boat, it doesn't matter. Your supervisor is primarily responsible for understanding whether or not you're achieving the objectives that you've been tasked to achieve. but it's definitely, I guess, and this comes from my position in the organization where I also have responsibility for IT. I feel like if we give people the tools they need to work from home, it shouldn't be that different than working in the office. But for the big matzo ball of childcare, and Wendy, who's our director of HR, has been really instrumental in making sure that all of our employees understand their rights and obligations, and making sure that we, the management team, understand our rights and obligations under FMLA and sick leave and all of these federal interventions. So there are people who say, I don't have a childcare alternative, what should I do? Well, we obviously could shake hands and say, yeah, you work your 37 and a half hours a week, and we'll both know while winking at each other that it's impossible to do that while also doing homeschool for your kids. But we've gone down the route of accommodating schedules, people working part-time, some people have taken leave. We had one employee just request to be furloughed. So I would say that we're measuring productivity in the same way that we did before, and that's primarily on the supervisor.
So Wendy, you work at JFS Detroit too, clearly. And so you are the one who are talking to all the supervisors and making sure that they know what they're saying, and it's okay with management that, you know, some people are now working 12 hours versus 37 or whatever. I don't know if other people are interested in this conversation or not.
A lot of the times the supervisors direct the employee right to me. We have a conversation, right? And then I'm circling back with the supervisor to see, you know, can we accommodate that schedule? If somebody needs to take, you know, Wednesdays and Fridays off, and for the most part, everything has been, you know, we're accommodating everything that we can. Like Jeff said, we had one person where we knew there really wasn't much work at all because she does home visits. And she said, you know, just furlough me. So, you know, based on that request and based on the lack of work, that's what we've done. But we're actually in talks with her, bringing her back, seeing what that looks like, redeploying her elsewhere in the agency. We've done a lot of that too. So helping people that maybe there's not a lot of work administratively, where can we redeploy you that needs help?
Is that what other people are doing on the call in Pittsburgh or Cincinnati?
So we haven't, we're a very small agency, so we really don't have a way to redeploy people. I think, and we have two different programs, one that's continued remotely, that's our Clubhouse. And so we're able to do a lot of that over Zoom and with phone calls. And I mean, I recognize that our staff in that program is not as productive as they would be normally if we had the normal attendance. And I accept that. I find that kind of staff is really hard to find, and it's not their fault that we're in this situation. So we're just kind of living with it. And then
you're new to this call and new to the whole network. And what's JRS? Because it's not a Jewish Family Service or a Jewish Vocational Service, right?
So it's our full name is Jewish Residential Services, and we do a couple of different things. Actually, the residential is a little bit of a misnomer, but we have a clubhouse that serves people with severe and persistent mental illness. It's a day program, a psychiatric rehabilitation program, and then we have a supportive living program that supports people who live independently and have intellectual or developmental disabilities. And you know, that's home visits, and that we had backed off from for a while and recently restarted. And then we have a group home that we operate with a partner who staffs that.
So, and you've been able to continue to work, or you haven't been able to continue to work in this?
We have been able to. You know, Pittsburgh also just recently had a big spike in cases, and so our clubhouse had reopened, and we had set up sort of an A group and a B group to try and limit the numbers. And we have quite a bit of space, so that's workable. But with the spike in cases, we're taking a 2-week break from in-person services there because we just felt like it was the prudent thing to do.
It's just so hard to operate, right? 2 steps forward, 4 steps back. It's hard.
1 arm behind your back.
Yeah.
I can just say in Minneapolis, and Diana, who joined the call, is also with me in Minneapolis. She's our HR manager. Very similar. I'd say the one thing that we haven't quite resolved is whether to stick with, for the people who are working less, whether we're going to continue to pay them for the regularly scheduled hours. I mean, that's how we have worded it from the beginning. The people will be paid for their regularly scheduled hours, and they should work as much as they can and work with their supervisors so that people understand what that is. And when we made a commitment, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, that we would continue to operate mostly as we are until Labor Day, as I'm sure many of you have as well. That's as far out as we went. We communicated the same thing again about regularly scheduled hours. But we just completed about a 2-week process of having every supervisor talk with every staff member to answer certain questions, ranging from, do you have the technology do you need, and things we that should have been being discussed, but some people just weren't. And I think we've realized the one thing is that people were muddling through. It was sort of, we had to figure out how to do this remotely, and we did. But when we did that, we thought we were going to stop doing that and go back to normal.
Right.
And now that we're doing this for many more months, we can't just, I mean, I think we've been doing really well. It's not like we've just been settling, but it's like, what is it really going to look like? You know, Jeff mentioned, are there clients who aren't really effectively receiving counseling on Zoom? Are there seniors who could be seen outdoors in person right now, who we've only been doing telephone reassurance with? What does that look like? So we've been doing that, but even with staff, and there's not a large number, but there are some staff, a handful of staff out of about 120, who are not able to work their regular hours, either because there's just not workload or workflow, or because of the childcare or other responsibilities you mentioned. And we have not really decided what is the appropriate or responsible or what should we do. And we've talked about, somebody mentioned, you know, trying to redeploy across other programs, and I think there may be some limited opportunities. It's just, you know, obviously if, you know, if you're a social worker or you're not a social worker, or you don't have a license, or you do, or you don't work with kids, or you work with seniors, you know, there's some limitations, but we're trying to get people to think beyond some of those limitations and see. But I would say, I think there will be a point at which we say it is not responsible for us with funding from government and donors to continue paying everyone for hours they cannot work.
Right. So that's going to be hard for you human resource professionals, right?
We did that in Detroit. So for a period of time, we paid everybody their regular schedule. And then for another period of time, we said, we're just going to pay you for hours worked. And I think we all slept pretty well at night because the supplemental unemployment benefit made people more than whole in that trade. But starting July 31st, we recognize, or I guess August 1st, we recognize that trade won't be as attractive. But I agree with Lee, like we could afford, in air quotes, to pay everybody to not work, but it's not responsible to our stakeholders to do that.
Yeah.
There is one possibility here, and I know not every state has it, but Minnesota does have, and you have to go through a lot of hoops, but you can do a partial unemployment piece where if you do a partial furlough, you can pay those wages and then they can still get the rest on unemployment.
That's how it is.
So, I mean, that can be a helpful opportunity if it's available, but I know sometimes it's either all or nothing.
What about the insurance? Does that make a difference? Is that something that you all contend with? Like if people are going into homes that they didn't normally go into homes, do you have to put them onto any sort of insurance? I'm not really sure. I don't even know if that's something that you all contend with. You know, liability insurance? Forget it.
But, I mean, I think
Forget
for
it.
Us particularly.
What do I know?
That insurance covers us, period. We don't itemize like this person goes into that home or that person goes into the other home.
Right.
And it's a work comp. I mean, it's ultimately, you know, workers' comp. So more than, liability could come into play, but.
I think the liability piece is more like, and this is the other thing we have to be thoughtful about is what happens if one of our employees gets one of our clients sick.
Okay. What about it?
So we're trying to implement some rudimentary contact tracing, and we're requiring our employees to answer several questions, and we're requiring them, or we'll soon be requiring them, to ask their clients the same questions. And then if somebody has symptoms, we at least have some way to get back to people and say, oh, your case manager was sick or is sick. Right. But it definitely, that's the most concerning part of putting our employees in people's homes. And not that we're equally concerned about the people we serve getting our employees sick, but generally speaking, our employees are less in the at-risk categories than are the people we serve.
So I guess Laraz has an experience with that, because people got sick, you know, from another person, you know, employees got sick from another employee because a family member was sick. Is that correct?
Well, thankfully, no, that did not happen. Not putting on a lot of wood here. But what I am, what resonates with me with what Jeff was stating, that what we are doing for our geriatric care managers who are seeing clients, they are actually signing, the clients are signing off on a client, liability, waiver of liability form. But prior to that visit, the geriatric care manager is also doing a symptoms check on themselves and also addressing those same questionnaires to the client. And so when they're visiting their client has to sign off on a waiver of liability.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But thankfully, no, none of our employees have gotten any clients or visitors ill. What I was stating before was that our employees have experienced their family members being positive for COVID. So that's what's happening right now for us.
So we've been fortunate that way too, but in Pittsburgh, the increase in cases has been tied to mostly young people, and our staff is primarily people in their late 20s and early 30s, and I worry more about them bringing it into the agency than getting it from one of our clients. And, you know, we've had some near misses where someone had contact with someone who had it, and fortunately everything's been negative, but that's a big concern here.
Yeah. It's a big concern everywhere, I think. And I think that's how Philip started it. We wanted to talk about DEI and, you know, what's happening and how are we talking about it with, you know, staff and communities and stakeholders and donors. And, you know, you talked about what's happening in Broward-Dade. So, and everyone is talking about that. You know, it's the new epicenter.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's like no end to it. You know, we had 15,000 cases Sunday, 11,500 yesterday. You know, they're just, you know, it's unfortunate. And you're right about that. The age group is going, you know, it's not the 45 and above now. Down here, it's 25 to 45 that has really increased.
But until those people go home or go to the grocery store, right? I mean, it's very scary. I think we're in worse shape now than we've been at any point since the pandemic started. Like, we haven't made any progress. We're going backwards. Southern California announced no school in person in the fall. That's, you know, whatever, 750,000 students.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's hard to just do our day jobs while managing COVID and being thoughtful about anti-racism. I mean, it's, you know, we talk about double bottom line or triple bottom line. It's like quintuple bottom line now.
Yeah.
Doesn't make our job easy. Unfortunate stuff. Do you guys, by some chance, do you guys have like a policy procedure? If somebody did get COVID-19 in the office or something, do you actually have a policy and procedure? Set the employees signed off on it and everything?
Yes.
No, we don't. I wouldn't call it as formal as a policy or a procedure. We're working with an app developer, so we'll push it out to our employees. They'll answer questions on the app, but they don't have to sign anything.
Well, Laura said she has one. right? Is that what you said?
Yes, we do. We have a policy and procedure. It's JFNC has screening and requirements. And so within the policy, it stipulates that the questionnaire is being done only when they're on a JFNCS work site. So each time they are on site, they're doing the symptoms check. Also, the policy states that if they do find that they answer yes to any of those symptoms checks, what they need to do, which is communicating with their supervisor and then with HR. In the event that someone does become positive, the policy does stipulate what that process is from the test, you know, taking of the COVID test and also the quarantine process.
Laraz, if you could you send that to
me?
I can put it into the resource library. Atlanta's always on the cutting edge of everything, you know. You were the first ones to create that, well, at least that I knew of in the network, to create that huge phase-in reentry plan. We had that webinar on it.
Yes, yeah, so Terry and...
now you're back to zero.
Yes, now we're back to zero, but I'll be glad to forward that through. Let me see if I can find that now.
Lisa, do you hear much out of Seattle? I know that they were sort of forced to figure this out first because that was the first landing spot in the States.
Yeah, we have that one, but I don't know if they have a policy and procedure. They're not on this call. But
ours is very similar to what Laraz described, and we just went from sort of, we have been emailing or doing different things to really documenting all of it and having everyone sign off on it, and we have an electronic form that you can do the screening if you're heading to the office or if you're going out into community, which is limited but happening. I think the piece that Diane and I were just talking about is we don't really have documented what does HR do when they're notified. So we have everyone, if you have any of these situations, you must notify supervisor or HR. You cannot go out into community to work. We don't really have sort of what is the HR side, what are they supposed to do? So we have to harden that, but we do have the other pieces in place and hardened that in just about the last 2 weeks.
Well, that is important for you all to harden that, right? For people to know what to do when you get the cases or when something happens.
And luckily,
what's going on in Cincinnati or DC? That's you, Deidre, or Jen.
We're a small agency too, and we are where we have been from the beginning. We haven't changed at all. We're not going in. We're all doing from home. But everybody that we're all seeming to be able to really do a lot and be extremely productive at home. We're doing more programs, different kinds of programs. We're continuing to work all virtually with our clients. None of our clients, you know, we're not seeing them in person. So it's all working out that way. So there's no foreseeable future of us going back into the office at all at this point, you know, for the long haul. So things are definitely worse here too, like everywhere else. And the schools are the big topic right now. But again, with being a small agency, it's a lot different, I think. And we do have employees. A lot of us have childcare issues. So it's working out. Like I said, everybody's being extremely productive. So it seems to be working out really well for us.
But you're right. I think that Jeff said it in the beginning or at one point about schools. You know, if schools don't go back again, I mean, it really will impact so many of our employees.
Oh, yeah. I'm screwed.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would be, but.
Yeah. Sorry. I just can't believe this is going to be happening.
You mean you personally?
Yeah, yeah.
With your children?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But so, I think the lobbyists at JFNA and all the smart people whose job it is to advocate rather than serve, if it's the case that schools are closed en masse, there's got to be some more legislation, whether that's additional FMLA or expanded criteria for FMLA. I mean, I just can't see a circumstance in which the government says schools closed all year, but figure out how to work. I just don't see it.
Yeah.
On either side of the aisle. It's just, it's not tenable.
There's five exercises.
Yeah, it's challenging, but we all are doing the best we can. But our office, we're extremely flexible. Whatever you need to do, everybody understands. Just get your work done. If you have to do it at an odd time, that's fine. Nobody cares. So it's nice to have the kind of culture and environment that we do.
Right. Did you want to say something, Jen? That sounds like I'm some people in the background.
I do. I have three children in the background who are signed up for summer school. So they're in different phases of summer school at the moment, which I don't know if that's good or bad. It was a struggle when we were still in school, and I've enjoyed the last couple of weeks of not being in school, but I needed some more structure for them. So now they are in doing some summer school activities, and then it brings the stress of us all being kind of located together on top of one another. So,
so you really get it,
this particular situation. Oh yeah, no, I get, I get it for sure. And our school system just released something over the weekend with some drafts, so that we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I imagine it'll be a hybrid between distance learning and in person. And we'll just see where that goes.
Well, JESS is a very large organization, right?
How so many? We have about 300 employees, and then we have a wholly owned subsidiary, which is Premier Home Care, which is another 150, 175 employees. So, I mean, for us, and I'm sorry, I joined late, so I don't know exactly where all of this started, but we've kept people whole comp-wise. We were committed to doing that to the extent that we could. We implemented hero pay for our nurses and our folks who are in the field doing one-on-one work with patients. We've had a handful of staff with COVID. Fortunately, only one was in the hospital and had it fairly, it was a fairly difficult situation, but she rebounded back home, back working. Everything's fine at this point, sort of knock on wood. But we've been following CDC guidelines on all of that. That's been our real sort of our guide in terms of how to manage things with staff, manage things with clients and all of that. We're not looking to go back to the office at all. We've done a nice job. It's been pretty seamless, I think, moving to the transition to working remotely. We just don't feel it's worth all of the resources and money that it would take to reorganize the office, to, you know, break up cubicles, to put in plexiglass everywhere. It just doesn't make sense when people are working efficiently and effectively from home. We did a survey, so we're part of the Leading Edge group as well. And so we did, they have these pulse surveys that they had given to participating clients. And so we implemented that with our staff about 3 weeks ago or so. And overwhelmingly, people feel supported, which was really great to hear. What sort of trends that we learned, people are, a couple concerns or challenges, one around like mental health, just sort of anxiety. And stuff, and then around mental health, anxiety, loneliness, fear of sort of the future, and then the other piece around challenges returning to the office is around cleanliness and safety. So it gives us, you know, something in terms of communication and what we can do. We're doing some things like automation of sinks and paper towels and foot pulls and stuff like that to get in and out of bathroom doors. But that stuff that's probably long overdue anyway, just in terms of just general safety and sort of where the world is going. Mm-hmm. But people overall, like I said, the feedback overall was that people felt supported. We do a lot of communication, much more than we ever did pre-COVID, which is, I think, fantastic for staff. And to Deidre's point, people have some flexibility to get their work done when they're working from home. And there's a balance. And we try to really touch base to see how people are doing, just knowing that we're all dealing with so much.
Yeah. A lot of your employees, though, aren't they supposed to be in the field as well? Are they going into the mm-hmm. field?
They are. So they're in people's homes.
Everything or whatever you have. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think you guys were a big part, NJHSA was a big part of making sure that we had enough PPE. But
big plug for yeah. NJHSA.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, we were fortunate. We brought on a CMO right before COVID, and thank God she's there because she's been such a blessing to help us. But she was really working on making sure that we had enough PPE because it was touch and go for a while. But now we are well stocked with everything that we could possibly need. And that was a real concern for staff. We've had a lot of staff who have brought in doctor's notes. So we're trying to accommodate and work around all of that because some of our positions can provide telehealth where there's social workers or chaplains and all, but the nurses really can't take blood pressure via telehealth, you know. So they are still going out into patients' homes or into facilities. the thing that we're wrestling with right now, this just came up over the last week, is that facilities that we work with are all requiring our staff to be tested for COVID on a weekly basis.
With the nose?
Well, could be up the nose, could be, so there's a couple different ways. Up the nose, in the like a tonsil swab, and now there's a spit component. So we've been working with a lab, this is our second week now, working with a particular lab to get us some testing, because part of the issue is we need the results back quickly. The facilities won't let you come in if your test results are more than 7 days old, but the labs are so backed up, it's harder to get them that quickly. So we've been working with a private lab, and it turns out now our county that we work in, that most of our services are provided in and most of our staff reside in, is starting testing for free, which will be fantastic, because otherwise it was about $15,000 and $18,000 a month to get everyone tested that needed to be tested, which is cost prohibitive. And that's really because the facilities were mandating it. And since it's not a medical necessity, insurance won't cover it. So it's just, that's been our sort of our fire drill at the end of last week and early this week.
It's always something.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So I'm curious, for the people who are maintaining compensation at the pre-COVID workload, did PPP play into that?
So definitely, we actually, for us, yes,
did it. So for us, we agreed to do it regardless. We did get the PPP money. We're hoping that it's a gift and not a grant or a loan, but it'll make things easier for this new fiscal year. Sure. But we had already made that decision prior to, so.
Jen, how did you find out about the private lab? That was so cool.
So actually, our chief medical officer knew of some folks in the area, and so it's just, she was able to work with this individual to get our testing. So she went up there and got a bunch of swabs, because we've got nurses there, you know, doing it up each other's noses and everything else. And so, which, yeah, from an HR perspective, like, I don't want to turn into a medical clinic, please. But so we were doing some of that, and then we were just taking them up to Baltimore to be tested, and we can get the results in 24 business hours, which was key. Yeah. So we get the results, and then it comes to me in a spreadsheet, and we just do a mail merge letter out to people, assuming that they're negative, just, you know, this person was tested, results are negative, kind of let them come and do their work sort of thing.
It's a good idea if you have any board members or any people that, you know, have an in, you know.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But we just know that we can't sustain the expense with it. So now that the county will do it, it's not quite as fast. So we're going to have to do multiple, people will have to be tested more frequently because they can't give us the results fast enough. But there are additional options. It's not just the uncomfortable sort of nasal option. There's other options for staff.
Yeah, no, down here now, it's just crazy because now you can't make it, you have to make an appointment, and you have to wait 3 to 4 days just to get an appointment. And now it's taking us 6 to 8 days to get the results back down here. It's crazy.
It is. It really is.
Yeah.
Governor, you got to do something with him.
Yeah. We don't want to talk politics right now.
No.
Well, my daughter is moving to Miami.
Oh, jeez.
So in like 3 weeks. And we're taking her down. So we'll have to quarantine, my husband and I, for 2 weeks, you know, on the way back, once we get back. But.
Yeah, especially Miami, because that's Dade County, which is the worst in the country almost right now.
Great.
Fortunately.
Any other COVID-related items that people are encountering or want to brainstorm about?
Okay, then let's talk DEI. We're back to that. What is human resources professionals doing, you know, to encourage whatever you want to encourage in your agencies? Has Detroit done anything? Or Minneapolis? I'm sure you guys are on it. But
well, I don't know that I'd say that, but certainly we've been in the spotlight, and for good reason. for bad reason, but for good reason, we should be in the spotlight because this is a long-standing, persistent problem of epic proportion here and
everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just own it for here. I mean, we have, you know, in the top three gaps in terms of the opportunity gap between people of color and people who are white, and any measurement you can find, there's a huge disparity here. There has been. And then the policing thing, this is by no means the first incident. And so all of that is happening, yes. In terms of the agency, we've been working at DEI for quite some time. Some of you may have participated in the plenary session where we had our board president and our CEO and the consultant, Melissa Adams, that we've been working with. And that was days before George Floyd was murdered. So since then, it's sort of figuring out, you know, from an HR perspective, we continue to do the things we were doing. You know, whether that's retention, recruitment, inclusion, microaggressions, things like that, that continue to be important in all facets of diversity. But then where do we go from here? And we do have a diversity committee that had not met in quite some time and has now met twice virtually in the last few weeks, including today. Diana and I were just in that meeting before we came here. And I think one of the most interesting things is the committee has a little mission statement, and the mission statement is very clearly focused internally. In the sense that it's about having the mission of the committee, and that's how we got to the consultant, and that's how we're doing the work we're doing, but it is about having people bring their full authentic selves to work and to be able to interact as their full selves with clients, with coworkers, with supervisors, with volunteers, with donors, so that others have that same opportunity. And in the two meetings and talking about what do people want to focus on now, there's been a real appetite for focusing much more externally. I don't think it's that people are saying we've solved all of that. Everybody feels fully included and belonging in the agency, but there's a very big appetite for more of the systemic kind of change. But there's a real wrestling with, well, what would that look like? And what we say in JFCS Minneapolis is, we are not an advocacy organization, but we are an organization that does advocacy. We have a committee that's become the most popular board committee to be on in the last 3 years is the advocacy committee. We actually partner with two other agencies, a food shelf that is in our building, and then Jewish Family Service in St. Paul that are in the same committee, which is the only committee we have that is multi-agency.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea.
It's worked well. And the committee's active, and that's everything from signing on to things that NJHSA sends out to working with local legislators to testifying at the Capitol when it's appropriate. We did our first full advocacy day at the Capitol a year ago. We were scheduled to do it on March 17th and had to cancel it due to COVID. And so now I think the question, you know, staff have not been that involved in that committee. I mean, I have, a few other staff have, but now there's a question as to sort of, is there a bigger intersection between staff work and advocacy committee work? And how do we partner with other agencies in the community to do maybe more systems change work? And if we do, you know, how much time can we allocate to that? Generally speaking, and during a pandemic, and should we, and is that our wheelhouse? And so I think that's sort of the best update I can provide as to how we're talking about it and what we're doing right now.
Well, I love that idea, and if it were to come to fruition that you worked with other agencies to become this, you know, advocates, we would love to have you come and talk at NJHSA, because I think it's really important that, you know, agencies band together, cities, nonprofits, to make a change. You know, this is the time, you know.
There's a another piece that comes to mind. The folks in this group read Vu Lee's NAF nonprofit as, has anybody seen that? So Vu Lee from V-U-L-E from Seattle has a blog every week and lots of stuff about diversity, equity, and inclusion and the nonprofit space. And Vu and a couple of other folks, maybe a half dozen people have started as volunteers, and I think maybe one staff member, are essentially trying to re-envision philanthropy and really to potentially bring systemic change to this whole structure, you know, what some people would call the, what do they call it, the, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex, which I had heard people say, and I didn't really understand what it meant, and it seems pejorative, and like, what does that look like? Yesterday, there were 2,700 people on the initial Zoom for this fledgling organization.
Wow.
And I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but I can send it out when I go back and look at some of the materials. This is a much bigger leap, and one that many nonprofits will feel uncomfortable to do because it is pushing back against the current structure in philanthropy. And the idea is, instead of having the structure where people who hold all the wealth give us the wealth when we ask for it and try to solve problems, how do we change that whole dynamic and bring power and wealth to communities, especially when most of the wealth is held by the same people who have held wealth, most of whom are white and have had it for a very, very long time. And nonprofits led by people of color are very under-resourced. But this collective, this group, seeks to turn that upside down with respect for and engaging philanthropists and engaging foundations, but with the goal of changing it. It's a huge aspiration, but the fact that 2,700 people tuned in yesterday and actually with some activities sort of broke two other websites that we all went to at the same time, there's a lot of appetite. And so if that's something that people are interested in, I can at least just send the link and you'll at least know about it.
I definitely would be interested in that. And I'm sure other people on this call would be too. Yeah, there's... So what are other agencies doing? That was really well said. And thank you for telling us everything that you're doing in Minneapolis. You know, even though you may not think it's that much, it's something. It's, yeah. Anyone else doing anything? What's happening?
We actually, after that... I'm sorry, go ahead, Idra.
Laraz, were you going to say something? No? Okay. Jeff.
So we actually, right after that plenary, we scheduled a meeting with what we call our admin group. So that's everybody who is not a capital S supervisor, but anyone who is the supervisor. So has direct reports. And for us, that's about 43 people. And we were planning to debrief the plenary that Lee referenced. And then the murder of George Floyd happened in between. So we had to change gears, and we spent most of that session talking about that. We actually had planned to bring in an NJHSA resource, sort of, Shanna Menkes in Winnipeg, who was trained to do the respectful workplace training with Tom Ode in New York. And we had planned to do that long before George Floyd, but we actually decided to postpone it because it just felt tone deaf to bring... like to bring a consultant in to do a full day session and have it not be fully about anti-racism. We were worried it would strike the wrong tone. Our CEO has been in touch with a handful of consultants around DEI, one of them in particular, the group in Minneapolis that joined that plenary or led that plenary discussion. And we also put together a 90-day anti-racism plan where we're trying to evaluate and determine many, many questions around anti-racism. So are funding sources explicitly earmarking their contributions for Jewish people, or is that a decision that we're making? Vendors, employees, marketing, we're sort of looking at all the aspects of the agency to figure out, is what we're doing... nothing anybody does is 100% intentional, but we want to make sure that what we do and how we do it is not just the random result of 93 years of small changes, but it's actually, we fully understand why we're doing what we're doing. And we're a very Jewish family service. Probably 80% of the people we serve are Jewish. And I think probably 80 or 90% of the dollars we receive are Jewish dollars. But we want to do a much more thorough evaluation of what that number is. And for each grant that we receive, we want to see explicitly, is there a provision that allows us to serve people who aren't Jewish? and specifically in our fee generating programs, particularly counseling, anybody who has an insurance card can come get counseling. So are we marketing that service effectively? And the other thing we did was we reached out to our employees of color. Perry, our CEO, did it one-on-one to just give them the opportunity to share their feedback, concerns, comments, whatever. And then a couple people shared in that 40-some person admin group just their experience being professionals of color. And in this particular case, they both happen to be Black. But just their experience interacting in the world and interacting with their colleagues at JFS. And I think we're really lucky. We have, a pretty good report card, but I think we have the obligation to see what we can do to get that report card to be a great report card. And one of the things that, I don't remember who said it, many people have said it, it's no longer enough to just not be racist. Like, we have to actively pursue social justice. And I think to Lee's point, right now we're really struggling with our board included to figure out what is our role as a little old social service agency in advocacy and social justice for the country, and how do we fit into that?
Yeah.
Hello. So Jessa, we're interviewing consultants right now, so I appreciate the information, Lee. I will add that to the list of folks that we're speaking with, but we're looking to engage in some work for the agency overall. I think we sort of feel similarly, I think, to you, Jeff, like we have some work to do. We're okay, but we want to be better at this, and what we've done at the senior sort of executive management level is we've started listening sessions and sort of prompting to have some tough conversations. And we're going to start doing that across the agency as well. So it can be done either in teams or it can be done in just people who sign up to do it. So people who don't necessarily work together, and just trying to surface issues, to just really kind of take a look back, have an opportunity to look at oneself and to just engage in conversation about what we need to be doing differently, how things would feel if they were done differently, and where's room for growth. So this is all, we're sort of at the infancy stages in comparison to where I think both Lee and Jeff are, but it's a commitment that we're making to our staff. It's multi-year, and this is not just a flavor of the day, check the box and send out a message to staff denouncing what's going on. Like, we really want to put a plan behind that we can continue to build from. We've also had conversations with our board. They recognize that as well, and they're committed to looking at themselves. We've wanted to have a more diverse board. We have a fairly white, 50-ish Jewish board. And so we'd like to, you know, over the coming years, be able to recruit and keep people of color that really represent the communities in which we're serving. So for us, we are probably by and large serving non-Jewish clientele. So certain programs of ours are more Jewish oriented. We have a 450-person Holocaust survivor program. Obviously, that's what that is. But by and large, most of our programs are not just geared towards Jewish individuals in the community. So we'd like for our board and our staff makeup to really represent the community that we're serving in a better way.
We figured out the employment side, and we didn't do anything to get there, but we're probably 70-30 Jewish, non-Jewish employees,
which we're about roughly, the same.
Roughly mirrors the people we serve, but the board is 100% 50-ish, right. Jewish-ish, like you said.
Yeah. So our staff, ours is the opposite. We're 65% non-Jewish staff, 35% Jewish staff, and then, yeah, the board is minus one person, 100% Jewish, so... Yeah, we've got a lot of work there to do. So, and we see mostly people of color in our organization at different levels, hospice, you know, aides, like some of the lower level positions. We want to find better ways to promote and attract. And I think, and I don't know if you all feel this way, but sometimes we still get the question, oh, do I have to be Jewish to work here? So, you know, that becomes just an obstacle in general sometimes with recruitment. And I think sometimes for people of color, that can be an even larger obstacle. You know, again, why looking at an organization do I have to be Jewish? And most Jewish right, or do I belong there? Would I feel comfortable? Like, just all of those. And so just trying to really do a better job with where our recruitment, what our recruitment looks like, and just bringing people into the organization.
So I want to do a time check. It's 2 o'clock. Lee said he's got to go. I actually have another meeting as well. If people want to stick around, Lisa, I don't know if you have a couple minutes.
Yeah, I do. I have another call at 2:30, but I think that we can leave if we want to. I was just going to ask Loraz, you know, because you're senior management, you're a person of color, you know, has Atlanta, JFS Atlanta, you know, done what they, what are they doing? What are they doing? And how are you feeling?
I would like to say we're in our infancy stage, as Jen had stated. We're actually hosting tomorrow our second discussion on racism, where basically the employees are able to come together on a Zoom call. We divide each of the employees into groups, and we have facilitators.
Facilitators from your agency or outside?
Within our agency, yes. So people who have either expressed that they wanted to become a facilitator and or some of our clinicians. So we have clinicians as well that are facilitating the group. So the group starts out with employees who have offered to share their stories, and they have been diverse individuals. So they're not all African-American, but everyone who wanted to share a story that have been involved with understanding what racism was and what their experience was. And then we break out into the groups, and the facilitators allow for the individuals within the groups to discuss what they understand from what they got from the stories, or just to share whatever they want in regards to their experience with racism. And so it's something that's not being guided. It's just trying to allow people to have a discussion about it. So this will be our second session tomorrow.
Did you think the first session was good?
The first session was really well.
Did you benefit from it? Or, you know,
was it? I think it was a benefit in that people had the opportunity to get a sense of what it meant to share and to hear those stories and get that discomfort out of the way. I think the comfortability, I think that's a term that people were trying to have to move forward to start this process. And we didn't know what that felt like. And so now we know what that feels like. And so now the second session will allow for probably a better and bigger discussion.
Right. So, you know, it's just so hard to talk about these subjects sometimes. Like, that's what Jeff had thought we should talk about. And, you know, we brought it up in the very beginning and no one really wanted to talk about it. And then we brought it up again and no one really wanted to talk about it. But now, you know, we were able to talk about it. And I think that's so important. You know, it's important for all of us too.
And I would love to hear from Lee, because he's probably already left the call, but
yeah, he had to go.
He talked about the diversity committee. I would love to find out what his committee looks like and how that evolved.
So I'll send you his email address after this and you can write him. He'd be certainly interested in telling you. Did anyone else want to share anything before we end, or about anything that's happening in their agencies or around this? Well, I can tell you that the network is creating a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee, and they're meeting, I think starting next week. They've already had one meeting, and the network's really looking to see who they partner with, who their vendors are, you know, what we're doing as well. Like, it's so important. And, you know, this was a horrible incident that the whole world finally got woke, you know, because it's been going on for a long time. But hopefully with nonprofits, we can all, you know, make a difference in our own communities, if not, you know, the whole country. But, you know, it's time. Time is now. So, Jeff, our next meeting is in, I should know, but I don't have it right with me. Do you have it? I don't know when it is.
Let me look.
We only have one more scheduled for the end of this. don't know what it is. I feel bad. I usually have it out.
So I don't see one at all, but let me try.
Okay, well, forget it. This should have been so seamless.
November 10th.
Okay, November 10th. Well, thank you all for coming. November 10th. You know, we're going to bring us whatever you think is important for us to put into the resource library. We want it. So just, you know, please do. And if you need anything, you can always write and the group will respond. So
thanks, everybody. Hopefully by November, more of us will be in our offices rather than in our living rooms.
Who knows? We hope. We really
hope. We hope.
We hope. Right.
Cross our fingers.
Stay on. That'd be great.
I will.
Thank
yeah.
Thank you, everyone. For
thanks, guys. Nice seeing
thank
you all.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You can kick Wendy off, Lisa. I think she had to step away to take a call.
She did. Okay. Hold on. We go. Remove. Okay, so I think that it went well. I don't know. It's hard to tell. Oh,